Hello, and welcome to this, the first episode of It's All About Choices. My name is David Barrow, and for those of you that don't know me, I've been working in IT service-related roles for 20 to 25 years. Or at least that's what I've been telling myself and others for about the last 5 years. You see, in November of 2021, I was presenting at a global conference, and I realized as I was presenting that my published profile was incorrect, and that this year marks my 29th year working in information technology, and it staggers me to think it's been that long. But once I'd got over the shock that I'm no longer young or new to the game, I reflected on the choices that I'd made that had led me to that day and realized that, do you know what, I may just have enough experience to help others on their career journeys who likely will face similar choices to those that I have faced in the past. But then something else came to me. Over that time, I have built up a network of colleagues, customers, mentors, and great friends who share similar experiences, but also completely different experiences. And we all work at multiple levels. And these people have had to make choices during their life and their careers in IT or elsewhere. So on this, the first episode of It's All About Choices, I'm going to be joined by a man I'm proud to call a friend, a mentor, and an inspiration. My guest is Zaf Khan. Zaf and I first met and worked together in 1997. And that's where I'd like to start this journey, as it's when my career moved from small companies to a place I'm sure most of us know. IBM Global Services. Zaf and I were both young, full of fun, but behind all of that, we shared a purpose and a drive that I honestly expect neither of us really knew how to harness at the time. We'll discuss the choices that led to us working together, and the choices that have led Zaf to today, and the choices he and I plan to make to shape our future. As we speak, you are welcome to ask questions via YouTube or LinkedIn, and we'll do our very best to cover them. Now sit back and relax, because Zaf is easily one of the most eloquent speakers I've ever met. So I invite you to join us and listen to how everything we've done has been all about choices. So Zaf, welcome. Welcome to this first episode of It's All About Choices. So far, it seems to be going well, so that's good. The nerves are starting to fade. But before we dive in, as well as thanking you for coming on to this episode, I'd just like you to tell us a little bit about yourself and also help me understand, if my recollection is correct, that we met in 1997 and really the choices that led you to that day.
Wow. First of all, Darth, thank you so much for inviting me on to this episode of your podcast, IT's All About Choices. I think the scope of what you're trying to do is brilliant and really exciting. I'm looking forward to where our conversation takes us today. In terms of my background, I accidentally fell into IT. So I had, like a lot of people, perhaps aspirations of doing something, but I wasn't sure what the something was going to be. Today would give me an opportunity to perhaps backtrack through some of those points where major decisions were made that led me to sitting here in this chair today. But in terms of background, I currently have co-founded an IoT end-to-end analytic platform that I'm working on at the moment. That's called Apero Data. Apero from the Greek word meaning infinity. So I've now become a startup co-founder, whereas I previously and initially started off working for this Goliath of an organization. And I never imagined in a million years that I would have had the opportunity to choose my way into this situation. And yet looking back, there are very tangible connections that have made the path from end to end. Let's get into it. What are you thinking?
Yeah, so, I mean, we met in 97.
Yes, we did. Yeah, you got the year spot on, that's right.
That's good, because my memory is obviously shocking based on me saying that I've only been doing this for 20 to 25 years. Now, my recollection is that we were working on a help desk in sale. But how did you arrive at that day? Because I think your journey was quite interesting in turning up in that beige work unit where you probably found me eating some kind of crazy sandwich and drinking some awful coffee.
I could almost smell the environment as you speak about it. The choices that led me there, I'm going to say you caught me, first of all, very early on in my career. I think before that point, I hadn't really had what you'd call a profession. I'd simply done jobs for money, which included a bingo caller, actually, two fat ladies, 88. And I'd done a newspaper round. I'd been a go-kart marshal and something called a filing systems engineer, which was nothing more than lugging cabinets around between banks. Banks were going paperless at the time. That was very fashionable. And I got involved in one of those projects, not with the computer side, ironically, but actually with getting the paper out of the paperless offices. So this was my sort of first professional job, working with computers and at this sort of scale. And I'd say three things led me there. One of them was the interest in computers. So I think at the early age of around six, I asked my father for a games console. And he responded by getting me this machine called a BBC B Micro. He believed it was a much more educational tool. So over the next few years, we wrangled with him trying to get me to learn basic programming and me trying to extract a gaming experience out of this box. So that was, I suppose, the first junction. The second was location. As you mentioned, IBM was in Sale, and I chose to go to university in Manchester. That meant I was right next door, you know, so that lined up really well. So that gave me sort of, the purpose, that gave me the location. But then finally, let's talk about the events that led me into the same office as you on that first day of work. I finished university. I wanted some time off. I thought, you know what? I'll get some flexible work. And I went to a recruitment agency in town. So this was in the center of Manchester. I was having my interview. And halfway through the interview, I think I made a choice to say something because I'd overheard a conversation about the HR software they were implementing. And they were having a problem with the rollout. And I didn't stop myself. I sort of had such a passion for computers. I piped up and said, have you tried A, B, and C? Well, they sort of took this quite well and decided rather than getting me a job with an external company, they recruited me into their own internal team to help with the rollout on that day. So I began working in this office environment, helping them do the rollout. And a few weeks or months later, I was sat around another table and somebody was talking about another professional conversation to do with computers. And once again, I piped up with a solution. Well, this person took that idea to their boss. And within a few days, they'd asked me in for an interview. And that interview was at IBM Sale. I got the job. And my first day into the office, I met my esteemed team leader, none other than the Dar Barrow Esquire that I'm talking to right now. So it was those three things. It was computers, location, and then not keeping my mouth shut that really led to us meeting.
That's fantastic. And I should explain to anybody watching who knows me as David that only in the walls of work do I ever respond to that name. You could shout Steve, and there's more chance of me responding the moment I leave an office or leave this home office. So for those that are wondering about Dar is what my family call me, it's what my friends call me, and Zaf is definitely amongst my friends. Not to say that those who are watching and know me as David aren't, I just only use it, I use David professionally, because it's so hard to explain why Dar. Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? Because you went to university and you found yourself there for those reasons. And weirdly, I didn't ever go to university, but what we found ourselves in the same place for very similar reasons. So you found yourself there because you contributed during something entirely unrelated to a solution that lives delivering that solution. I find myself there because I work for a really small training company in Wilmslow and trained the people on that desk. They were working, if you remember, it was BP Mobile at the time.
Yes.
The joint venture. And weirdly, there'd been an agreement that was put in place that only certain members of staff could support BP and other members could support Mobile. And IBM being IBM, they said, well, we'll just swivel chair it, which for those unfamiliar with service desks or help desks means that you could serve either customer. You just swivel your chair around is the premise of that. And so I trained the people in the common operating environment of mobile and the common operating environment of BP, which sounds grand. It was really just Word, Excel, you know, basic Microsoft stuff. And they said to me, wait a minute, why are we paying you to train these people? You could just come in and work on the service desk or help desk. And so we both ended up in that location for really very similar reasons, in that we did something that was maybe out of the scope of the conversation we were involved in at the time and chose to pursue that. And I think it's really interesting that we did that. I mean, if you think back to that day, and I can remember after work more than I can remember during work, if I'm perfectly honest. But what were you thinking on that day when you came into that environment? Did you think wrong choice, or did you think, oh, this is a bit of me?
Put it this way, if you're an animation fan and you got an opportunity to work for Disney, that was the level of excitement that I had as somebody who was passionate about computers and had been invited to work for, you know, the IBM. So I had this picture in my head of what I thought it could be like. And apart from the environment being tremendously beige, as you mentioned, it was an exquisite sort of eye blast of beige. The thing I remember most about the first day was sheer terror. What I didn't realize was how my inner perfectionist would come up to strangle me on that first day, because I think from what I remember in the morning, I was given a bunch of folders and documents, which were sort of, you know, processes, procedures, and best practices, and that I was fine with. And then after lunch, you basically dragged me over and said, right, well, we're going to get you on a call this afternoon. And I was like, what do you mean this afternoon? No, I need weeks and months to prepare. And so you let me listen in on some calls, and then before I knew it, you got me on a live call, and I was petrified. I was genuinely scared. As somebody who's not typically scared of a lot, I was extremely nervous. But what I do remember about that day is that, you know, you guided me through it really well. I got loads of encouraging feedback straight after the call. It was almost like doing a parachute jump. You know, you kind of you question your sanity afterwards, but during it, you're just so excited to be there. And it was a brilliant way to sort of onboard people, because you can sort of lose people's attention by onboarding for too long. Mm-hmm. You can also build up too much expectation if you don't let them get in amongst it. So I didn't have any of that, you know, delay. What I remember was going from sheer terror to pure joy, and then going home at the end of the day thinking, I can do this. So it was quite a roller coaster of a day.
I bet. And you know, I remember there's a couple of things I take from that. Firstly, it's kind of bizarre for me that I work in what I do today, because I remember looking at those processes at the time. And today I refer back to those processes. But at the time, I was like, we don't need those. Let's just get on and do it. And I, you know, I realized the error of my ways of experience. But also, I think, you know, you weren't the first person to come into that desk on that day, on a day, and try and take those calls. You were, I think, there's several people that had a go, some from within the IBM, others externally. And I think if I look back and think about the type of person I was then, and some of that I still hold today, I think that comes down to your ability and the trust that we had between us, that you did that. You know, we very quickly chose to trust you and say, just get on, just do it, because as I've said before, you're incredibly eloquent, but also naturally, you know, you have an affinity for information technology. So it was one of those things where, what's the worst that can happen? Let's just get on and do it. And I remember those. I still talk to people to this day about the culture of IBM. I was in IBM in different roles, probably for a little longer than yourself. But I think that culture and, you know, it's a fairly rigid organization. It has some fairly set principles, but we were given an awful lot of trust at a pretty young age, with a fairly big deal. And I think I'll always carry that with me, that was, maybe the choice to go in there wasn't a conscious choice, but the choice that to stay there, and the work we did was incredibly conscious, and I think we achieved a lot. Do you have any recollection about what we achieved during that period? And I'm thinking about trips to Milton Keynes and stuff like that.
I think that fits into sort of two categories. There was personal achievement and then sort of professional achievement. Certainly professionally, we created an incredibly, as you said, trusting and collaborative environment, right? I think even people who worked with our team probably thought we were a much bigger team than we actually were because of how productive we were with the small number of people that we had. Professionally, I remember just knocking it out of the park for the numbers. You know, we were really productive. But it didn't feel like a slog. As far as I remember, it was fun to come into work, and it was, you know, a relief to leave. But we worked hard all day, and we made results. So it wasn't in any way laborious or arduous for us, because we were killing it.
We were. And do you reflect upon that time in terms of, you know, the choices that you made today? Is there anything from those days that still resonates today that you apply in your day-to-day work today, or in your day-to-day thinking or decision-making?
I would say there's three real key tenets that I took away. And one of those was sort of working with, you know, business at scale. I hadn't really understood up until then why a person couldn't just change a password like this. Why did it take 3 or 4 people to get involved to get that job done? Right, I had almost next to no understanding of security at the time. And as I've sort of gone through my career, I've started to understand that you always want to look back at the busy stuff, organize it, put it into a process, document it, get it off your plate, and move on to the next innovative thing. Otherwise, it just keeps growing the amount of stuff that you've got to manage on a daily basis, and it becomes untenable. So one of the things I learned was, you know, if you're learning to eat an elephant, how you do it with small chunks. But once you've got those chunks, organize them, put them into some sort of order. What a macabre example this is turning into. And then you make sure that that's optimized. So that'll definitely be one of the key things that I took away, is how well IBM managed, you know, complexity at scale. And it immediately gives you a lens on every other situation you're looking at. You immediately walk in and you start looking for, well, where's the documentation? Where are the processes? Where are the, you know, the various managers of departments? What are the inputs? What are the outputs? What are the variables? And it gives you a way to analyze almost any business scenario.
Yeah. And you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking to myself, even this week, I've run a workshop where I've spoken to people about boiling the ocean or eating the elephant, where I've said, and these are lessons that we both learned then, that, you know, you look at what you're doing, or what you're doing well, what you're not doing so well. And then you understand what you could be doing next week that you're not doing this week. That's simple to do. It's effective. It's optimized. It's optimization. It's automation. It's lean. Give it any label you want. And you just take those small bite-sized chunks and you quickly overcome them, put them into your working practice, and you continually evolve and improve. And that's definitely come from our time at IBM. I can't remember the second example now, but there was something else you said there. But I think it's just great that, you know, that hangs with both of us. We work in different fields now, but, you know, it's still broadly IT related. But the fact that we've been able to diversify from one another's career path and yet still reflect back on those lessons, those choices that we made back at IBM is incredible. And I think it's credit to that organization. This was the other thing, sorry. So also I'm labeled an enterprise service management consultant. I used to write enterprise service management processes for IBM, but I had no concept of what enterprise was. Seriously, it was a starship. That's as far as it went in my eyes, even though it had a label of enterprise. But IBM taught me what an enterprise looks like. You were saying it there, the who, the where, the what, the why. They taught us all those things. And we didn't even know we were being taught them. And I think it's incredible.
Yes, absolutely. Yep, that's so true.
So coming back, so we worked together. If I think correctly, I believe I was there 97, 98. I know at some point in 99, I accepted the opportunity to go and work on a service desk in London, and I'll talk about that, I hope, in a future episode. I just need to try and rope my old help desk leader who employed me into that episode in a few weeks. But what happened with you? What choices were you making at the time, and what came next in your life and career?
Let's look at the sort of before and after the event of leaving. So before the event of leaving, as well as having sort of learned through osmosis all of this kind of, you know, discipline around enterprise practice, one of the things I'd learned, and I have to be, you know, as frank as I can be about this, is that we were a small cog in a large machine, and things didn't move quickly enough for an overexcited 20-something-year-old that I was at the time. And what I realized, I suppose, was number one, just because you work for a big organization, it's not upper management's job to make life easy for you. That's not what they're there for. I had a feeling it was some sort of resort spa where you just turned up and, you know, you would ask people to arrange something and it would change the following week. It's nothing like that. I think one of the great lessons that I got from the field was, if you want something to change, own it, change it, and share it. And if you can prove that it brings profitable change — now profitable is a key word — if you can prove it brings profitable change, then you can have it, you know, company wide. And in a place like IBM, you would throw, you know, the idea up the chain, and it may come back down 6 months later with extra bells and whistles on it, looking nothing like your original idea. But that's how the process was done, right? I learned that if you wanted to apply quick changes, maybe that wasn't the ideal world. So when our contract came to an end, I thought to myself, you know what? I think I'm getting a hang of this, you know, Microsoft-based desktop environment. I think I can take these skills somewhere else. And so going to a smaller company, and you know, a lot of other large companies were still smaller at the time, I thought, I can get more visibility, I can get more autonomy, I can get more independence. And so that's really what happened. That was the catalyst in the thinking that I want my ideas to be applied more quickly. And if I stay at IBM, it's a 6 month to 12 month cycle to get ideas in place. If I move, it might be shorter than 6 months. I didn't know, but I guessed. And so the after effect is, I had a conversation with another friend. They were talking to a recruiter. They said, "Hey, Zaf, you should talk to this recruiter." I said, I shrugged my shoulders like, okay, go on then. And the next thing I knew, I got a call back saying, yeah, this company, you know, wants you on board. When can you start? And so that was my sort of off ramp from IBM. And the things that I took away were, you know, managing problems at scale. Now, there's a book called The Rational Manager. And in there, they sort of looked at massive samples of how to get a problem solved effectively. And the four sort of components that they broke it out into was, what is the problem, what the problem is not, mm-hmm. how do you fix the problem, and how do you stop it repeating? And the thing I think we did really well at IBM was, how do you stop the problem repeating? Because in actual fact, you can go through the first three segments of analysis, and you can end up with a problem that just repeats, but more slowly. So if previously it showed up every week, what you've done is put in a temporary fix, and now it shows up every 6 months. So that isn't, you know, an efficient way to run your business. You've got to get to that fourth step, where how do you stop the problem from repeating again in the future? And that brings me back to that idea of, you know, sort of own it, change it, share it, and it stops that same problem happening to other people in the future. So that was one of the big sort of takeaways for me after leaving IBM, is I took that mentality, you know, forwards with me. I think some of the other things that I took away were definitely, have you heard this mnemonic, picnic?
I hadn't heard it until we had a brief chat in preparation, and I saw it and thought, that is absolutely fantastic.
I wanted to bring this up because it's something that, you know, I still makes me chuckle. Picnic is problem in chair, not in computer. And although it's sort of, you know, humorous, one of the things that I actually took away from IBM is, if the software or the, you know, the hardware is not making the user's life easier, it's actually not doing a great job. You know, just buying a solution that looks good on a PowerPoint is not enough. It's got to work in the hands of the end user. You know, the number of users that I saw that felt that they weren't being as productive as they wanted to be because they didn't know how to use the tools really reminded me that you've got to make solutions that the end user can actually apply. If you just show people numbers and say, well, another company, you know, created this return on interest and that they were able to implement it in this time scale and you know, they only paid XYZ for it, that's great. But that end user experience has to be authentic. And that's certainly, there were a number of stories that sort of cropped up from our time at IBM. But I think there was one in particular, if you don't mind, I'd like to share it.
No, please do.
And that was to do with a user who was, he was more elderly, right? I won't mention any names, but he was, you know, coming close to retirement. And typically he wouldn't have put himself into this position where he's working with brand new tools and technology, but he really loved the company he was working for and he felt that he could add value. So he did the job. He called me up one afternoon and he had this particular problem and we talked our way through it and we're trying to work out what it is not. And it had gone on for a while and he started getting frustrated. And it got to the point where he sort of, you know, espoused, if you just gave me a piece of paper and a pencil, I could figure this problem out in 100 different ways. He said, but I just can't make the tools do what I know my brain is trying to do. And he was breaking up. He was getting emotional. And I thought, this is the exact opposite of what IT is supposed to achieve. You know, we should have made his job so that he could do 10 times as much as he previously could using the tools that he had. And here's somebody who's doing 10% of what they previously could, and it's crushing their spirit. So, you know, another sort of mantra that I took away is, you know, creating motivated employees by giving them the right resources at the right time is critical to your business. And the smartest part of your business is still a human being. So, you know, enabling those human beings to be smart is exactly what you want to do. And that's something that I sort of that stuck with me forevermore. And I still try to implement today. Empower the human.
Absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head with enable and empower. That's surely what we're here to do. You know, a lot of us get caught up in IT around, you know, bells and whistles, fancy new things. And I think another thing that we share, and we shared the day we met and we share to this day, even though we do different roles, is enabling our customers, our users, our consumers to actually add value to their day. We want to make life easier, not more difficult. We want to enable them to do a great job. And I think, you know, for me personally, some of the choices I've made around my career have been where I've not been able to do that because I've not had the control, the necessary authority. And working in a company like IBM, it's very either time-wise a long time or just incredibly difficult to put yourself in a position where you have that level of control. And I would suspect, if I'm honest, that once you achieve that position, you probably still don't have that level of control anyway. And I've actually, certainly in my career, made choices where I've moved on based on the fact that I've not been able to enable my customers like I'd want to. But I mean, in your case, because I completely also agree about being well motivated as an employee, or indeed motivating the employees of the organization you work for or its customers. Have you ever been in a situation where you've been demotivated through either of those scenarios, either you're demotivated generally or you can't achieve what you want to achieve? And did you ever make a choice as a result of that feeling that was anything other than correct? In, you know, looking back, have they always been the right choice based on that emotion, or is there something that could have, maybe if you reflect back, you think maybe I could have.
No, that's an enormous question, but there's definitely one, I would say, main example that I can think of that really applies to, was there a time where I was demotivated and perhaps made the wrong choice, right? Right and wrong can be a matter of perspective sometimes.
Absolutely.
But there was certainly a time when I had an opportunity to work abroad. I was enjoying the work. I perhaps took on more than I could handle in terms of personal plus professional. And the choice that I think, and that started to wear me down, right? So over time, carrying the burden that was a little bit too big for me started to slow me down. And the choice that I made, that in retrospect, I possibly could have made a better choice, was to keep it all internal and try and fix it myself. And I think the right choice now, looking back, would have been to reach out and say, you know what, guys, I need help, either from my team or from an individual. I need help. And I didn't ask for that help. I basically kept stuff inside and just kept marching on, thinking, you know, if I'm a good trooper, it'll resolve itself. And that was actually not true at all. Things slowly started getting more and more difficult. I could see the solution getting further and further away. And in the end, it came as a result of multiple people coming together to prop me up and give me the support that I needed. And then I got back on track again. But, yeah, you know, that was the choice that I made, to try and just handle it on my own. Because up till then, you know, I thought that's the way to do everything, is just run at the wall harder. But there are other ways around the wall. And, you know, sometimes somebody can just offer you a stepladder. So same wall, but very, very different result. So that was a really important lesson, earned the hard way. But I would say I'm much more comfortable now reaching out for help. It's not a slight on me. All it ends up doing is slowing the rest of the team down over time. So let's avoid that. You know, get the silly question out on the table, and somebody inevitably will either help or help you find help.
Yeah, I've been as you were speaking, then I was thinking about whether to ask this question or not, because part of me doesn't know the answer myself. But I've been there myself, and I wonder if some of it comes down to when we worked as help desk analysts, we didn't necessarily have technology that enabled us, let alone enabled the customer. So we were often on the hook to find a solution by hook or by crook in the 2.5 minutes we were allocated, which always amused me. But we'd always find a solution. We'd find a way. It's amazing how many ways we found. And probably at that point in our career, we weren't so good at actually making that knowledge explicit and sharing it. And yeah, I wonder if at some point that's what kicked in for you and I when we've been in those situations, until we've learned the hard way. And then figured, do you know what, I could have handled this a little better, or as you say, reached out. But I think we worked in a role where there was no reaching out. You're on that line, you've got to make that person happy, and you're going to find a way to do it.
I think that's exactly the pattern that was ingrained in us. We were, you know, essentially airborne rangers dropped into various situations, and you simply had to find a way out and often take your customer with you and make sure that they were happy and comfortable and safe. And so that's the only way we operated for quite a while. So I totally agree. Perhaps that had got ingrained, but those choices that I made to keep things inside certainly managed to kick me in the backside.
We've all been there. And I think that's really the point of this, this series, for anyone that's watching, is we're all at different stages in our career, and we all face conundrums, choices. And I don't think any of us handle them all 100% correctly 100% of the time. So hopefully between you and I and anyone else that joins, we can help people understand that sometimes it's okay to get it wrong, and also maybe help them not get it wrong in the future. So it's very good of you to share that. Thank you. So what choices have led you to today? What does today look like? I'm going to turn this light on next to me, by the way. I feel like I'm getting...
Yeah, go ahead. We're talking about a 20-year arc, but I can definitely think of two maxims that have essentially been my guiding light through those 20 years. And I suppose it's the difference between being reactive and being in some way proactive with your choices. And those two maxims are, number one, it comes back to that story about the Excel spreadsheet, is only work with companies that make life easier for your end user. right? There's a lot of extraordinarily complex software out there, and there's lots of stories in the field of how unhappy end users are using these pieces of software, but because they get the job done, they have to use them, right? They complain about them, but they have to use them. I always said to myself, if I can avoid it, I'd rather not work for one of those organizations. I'd rather work for an organization where people said, you know what, I went to work today and I got XYZ done, and they don't even mention the software because it was so seamless to get their tasks achieved. They weren't even thinking about the software. Shouldn't be this sort of opaque layer that they need to work with. It should be transparent. They just got the job done, and that to me is great software doing its job. So I've always tried to work with software companies, and I've worked now with only software vendors for many, many years. So I've always been close to the flame, the people who are creating the software. I've tried to work with vendors who were not so arrogant as to say, it's my way or the highway, it's all me from wall to wall, but actually I'm a good corporate citizen. I will fit into your governance. I will fit into your compliance policies. I'll fit into your security, and I will fit into your maintenance and release cycles. All of these details, these day-to-day details that people need to consider. And as a software vendor, I wanted to work for people who would make life easy for the end user and for the people owning the software. And that's with the amount of information that's out there in the field today. That was quite easy and straightforward to do. I could easily get a grip on what sort of vendors I wanted to work for. So that was definitely one of my guiding lights through the last 20 years.
And sorry, Jeff, while you're on that note, I just want to say we've actually had a question, and I think it's an appropriate time to ask the question. Right, hopefully I don't disturb your flow too.
No, not at all. Carry on, please.
I'm going to try and show this question. First time on here, so thanks to Chris Byrne for submitting this question. Chris asks, do you think nowadays, especially in service-centric IT roles, there is more pressure on individuals to get it right first time? Or do you think people are more understanding given the spotlight on mental well-being, etc.? Thanks, Chris. That's a good one for us. I thought we were at the perfect point because I know what comes next in your arc. I think we're still in that service-centric bit there.
So the first word that popped in, and thank you, Chris, for the question. I think it's a really insightful question, and it's very much of the time. With our environment being what it is with COVID and Brexit, time pressure and cost pressure is probably the highest it's been in a long time. The first word that popped into my mind was innovation. And that is, where is your company on that sort of spectrum of innovation? Are they trying to become a leader in your particular industry or segment, specifically with regards to services? Are you trying to get that leadership position, in which case you need to innovate? And with innovation comes an acceptable rate of failure, right? If you're innovating and you're failing 9 times out of 10, perhaps it's time to change tack. But I think an acceptable rate of failure has to be at least 2 times out of 10, right? And potentially, if you're a developer, it's way higher than that, way higher than that. So are you in that innovation cycle? That's what I would ask. Because if you are, there has to be an acceptable amount of failure, even within that sort of time and cost pressure. Now, if you're not in that innovation cycle and you're in that maintenance cycle, so you hit your stride and you know who you are and you know where you'd like to preserve your position, then you really don't want to be making mistakes. Then you're looking for 5 9s accuracy in everything you do, Lean Six Sigma methodology to sort of squeeze and optimize every single part of the chain. And one of the areas that I was working in a few years ago was talent management and resources. So that was in the HR space, really optimizing what is it that your human beings are doing on a day-to-day basis. We've now got enough machine learning and robotic process automation to really optimize all the electronic and digital and data components of a process. How do you now optimize the people components of a process? Now, you have to be careful in today's times because people are stressed. People are under a lot of duress, a lot of different influences that they weren't 5 years ago. So you really need to be quite sensitive with how you balance those people resources as part of your process. But and I would say there is a much longer answer to that as well, Chris. But let's go back to the top of the question, which is, it depends on where you are in your innovation cycle. If you're trying to innovate, then you need to have an acceptable rate of failure. And that's something the COO needs to get on board with, right? So the CFO needs to know, if I invest this amount of money, it won't all convert 100% into profit. But I need to invest this amount of money in order to have acceptable failures that then bring me a profit-making service or add-on capability to my existing services.
And I think if I add to that very briefly, I think there's a lot of companies that talk a lot about their culture, who express an open, honest, collaborative culture, but actually, when it boils down to brass tacks, maybe don't exhibit those behaviours. And some of that absolutely comes down to the area they work in. It comes down to the level of governance that's placed upon them, the level of development and innovation. And all those things need to be considered when it comes to actually get it right first time, because service isn't necessarily, in my mind, about getting it right. It's about managing the expectation, managing the outcome, and managing the messages. And I think that's what we got from working on that service desk, was a lot of pressure to get it right first time, but we also developed strategies that enabled us to manage the output and the expectation where we didn't quite get it right. So, Chris, thank you. I really appreciate that. That's a great and challenging question. Hopefully, we've answered it in a nice manner. So, Zaf, I did stop you on your track, but I knew you were moving into that automation piece, and that's kind of where I could see this sort of dovetailing. So, sorry.
So I would definitely say the second pillar of some decision making that helped me after leaving IBM and all the way up until now, was getting closer to the decision maker. Mm-hmm. So that was something, as I moved through different layers of the enterprise in terms of my career, often I found there was a plateau of understanding and of the ability to affect change, right? And at that plateau, the only thing you could really do was say, oh, well, that decision was made further up the food chain. It's not under my control anymore. So there's so much autonomy that I've been given. I can work within these parameters, but actually that decision, the one that you think will improve this situation, was made further up the food chain. So I've consistently tried to shape my career in a way that I was getting closer to the decision maker. And that could be decision maker, that team leader, it could be then manager, it could then be business department head, it could then be director, it could then be COO, it could then be COO, it could even be board level and investors. There's always another ear to sort of capture. But I was constantly trying to get to the next level of decision maker, whatever sort of direction I was heading in. Because the number of times I had conversations, especially when I had a stint as a trainer, where I would say, you know what, guys, there's a way you could do this that would just make life better for everybody, for you, for your organization. And they would say, we can't do that, Zaf. The decision's already been made and it's out of our control. And at that point, I felt, you know what, there's something we need to do about this. We need to preempt some of these gaffes happening further downstream. And so I kept telling myself, if I'm sitting down at the right table with the right decision maker, then I've got a better chance of influencing and persuading them to make the changes before it becomes a problem, right? So that was my thinking. So if we take those two pillars, one of them was make the software effective and easy to use, and the other one was get closer to the decision maker. And I just kind of kept by those two principles, and somehow I ended up here today.
It's incredible. So, you've consciously chosen to act as the instigator of innovation, but also put yourself in a position where you can deliver that innovation to that person that makes a decision. And
that's such an elegant way of putting it. I would say, in much more vulgar terms, I'm allergic to stupidity. So I simply can't tolerate poor design or bad decisions for that long. I have to do something about it. So it's my own affliction. But I definitely like the way you put it. It was much more elegant.
Oh no, I think it's great. This is why I love these conversations, because we can still, after all these years, learn about one another. And I think that's absolutely brilliant. So I know your career arc has taken on several different roles. How have they come to you, or how have you sought them out? How has that worked for the last 20 odd years? What choices did you make in terms of how you approach that?
I'm going to try and boil this down to a single lens, because, you know, over a period of time, there are perhaps too many individual choices to rationalize. But I can certainly say there's one lens that I try to look through consistently that has kind of drawn me onto the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And that lens, I think, had to be, how do I put this? I suppose it was always being a problem solver, right? That's the simplest way that I can actually put it, is if I wipe away all the titles and the roles and the locations and the salaries and all of that, I've actually effectively been a professional problem solver for over 20 years now. That's all I've ever done. And I've joined new roles and new organizations where they've tried to sort of tell me this is, you know, the artifacts around what it is that you're doing. But the lens that I keep seeing everything through is, oh, right, so you've got this many problems and it's up to me to solve them. And that's all I've ever done. And that means that I'm very comfortable having conversations with anybody in the organization from top to bottom, because ultimately there's somebody that's coming to me with a problem and I'm trying to respond with a solution. That's it. You know, if we take away the politics and the titles and the various other ambitions that get in the way of these clean conversations, the way that I see it through that lens is you've always just been a problem solver. Forget about the job title. That's all you actually do. And if you can solve a problem for one person, you get paid X. And if you can solve a problem for 100,000 people, you get paid Y. And if you can solve a problem for 1 million people, you get paid Z. That's kind of it. That's my simple version.
I like that. And I think if we go back to you being a problem solver, an innovator, and somebody that seeks and makes the choice to get closer to the decision maker, how have you seen your engagement change over that period? So, you know, I remember a time for both of us where you'd be trawling, I was about to say CV library or something. It probably didn't even exist when we started looking at it. There probably was no such thing. It'd be calling into that recruitment office like you did. But have you seen those engagements start to come to you because, you know, your reputation precedes you, your results precede you, and have you chosen to take that path, or did that path find you through your excellent work?
I would definitely say that path found me, because I'm also a person that needs to try very hard to focus. I get distracted by shiny things all the time. All of my teachers were sort of the same opinion that if only he could focus, you know, he would achieve amazing things. And so the hardest thing for me was not to keep looking at all the new job offers and opportunities that were coming our way, because I kept trying to put myself in that sort of leading edge of technology. So from data integration to business process management to business activity monitoring to business intelligence to big data analytics, and now to co-founding, you know, a company. Even now with Apero Data being what it is, we're getting an awful lot of interest of people coming along and saying, well, you know, can we buy you up? It's all I can do to say, you know what, I have to put boundaries up to say, I'm doing this job now and I want to do it really well. And if that created a reputation for me, that was a byproduct. And that means people keep coming back over and over again and saying, I've heard of you, or I've met somebody that's met you. Or alternatively, they'll know the people that I've worked with and the companies that I've worked with. And that automatically gives me credibility. So it's been a byproduct, a nice coincidence, luck, if you will. But my main focus was always do the best job I can for the customer in front of me, and the rest will take care of itself. And by some fluke, it did and still does.
It's really great. And I'd like to, because we've only got 10 minutes left, this time is flying, which is hopefully as good for us as it is for people watching as well, because hopefully it's flying for them. But I'd like to talk about Apro a little bit. This platform is not really about selling or sales, but I've come to understand some more about what you're doing with Apro, and I'd love you to explain the choices that led you to a couple of those things, and I'll let you explain what they are. But I found it incredible that we've known each other for 27 years, and I only learned about these things in preparation for this conversation. So yeah, I'd love it if you could share what they are and the choices that led you to them.
I'd be more than happy to. Yeah, I typically like to keep, you know, work to work time, and as certainly between you and I, we've got so much other things to, there's so many other things to talk about that we don't need to flood it with, you know, I had a bad day at the office type conversation. But yeah, over the past 3 years, myself and my lovely wife Nasia, we've been building up our own startup. So we've got a background in data integration and data analytics. She's got a background in telecommunications, and we decided to put those two sort of worlds together. Not because we set out to do that. The choice that was behind that was we had a family member that was beginning to struggle with memory loss. And what we found was that sometimes they'd leave the house with a perfectly clear frame of mind, and they'd take their familiar route to a location, but then they would lose their focus and not know where they were anymore. Suddenly, they would start to get affected by the memory loss. That was dangerous for them. It was incredibly frightening for us. And we realized that there were ways we could help. And so we thought, how can we actually utilize technology? And this is something that, you know, Nasia drove and said, well, why don't we make him a personal tracker that's a lot more wearable than a phone? So, you know, IoT was on the rise. Wearable smart devices were available. So we actually pulled together some developers. We got the hardware. We put the a solution together. And we went out to find some partners to say, hey, if this could work for one of our family members, we think other people could benefit from this as well. And what happened was, during that journey, one of our partners turned out to not live up to their end of the bargain and actually left us high and dry. So we were missing quite a valuable capability as you know, to be able to offer that solution. So we said, okay, let's build it ourselves. You know, if it's not available, it's not in the market, then why don't we make it? And we were quite cognizant that we were going up against absolute giants in the market, because, you know, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon were moving into that space at, you know, at pace. But we also knew that there were thousands and hundreds of thousands of small, you know, enterprises that didn't need that sort of, you know, space shuttle level approach, that needed something that was simple, worked out of the box, had all the requirements they wanted, and they could scale up and grow into something more mature over time. So that's exactly what we did. We built our own IoT end-to-end data analytics platform. And now we're using it for use cases that we think bring value to, you know, the world we live in. And that's the opportunity that really making your own startup gives you, is you can choose who your customers are. So we said, well, let's go and help the sorts of people that, you know, we always wanted to help. And after starting with the healthcare, you know, use cases, we ran into two sustainability use cases. One here in the UK and one in Africa, both of which we're tremendously excited to be involved with. One of them is looking at the growth and erosion of natural forests in the UK. So we've got one in the north of England where we're looking at effluent in the nearby water and the water temperature. We're looking at growth and erosion of the forest, and a variety of sensor readings that we're taking and sending back via satellite to government agencies, who are then using that to understand the state of the countryside, you know, in places here in the UK. And the other project that we got involved in was solar related. So I've been a big fan of solar for a long time. We were having conversations in Africa with a variety of IoT leaders, and we ran into a project where people were using their energy up from month to month or over their billing periods without knowing how much energy they'd actually use. So every time they got a bill, it was a surprise. And when you're on a limited budget, it was often a horrible surprise. So we're working together with a partner out there to provide clean energy that's cheaper than what they're paying at the moment, and also give them visibility into exactly how much energy they're using on a minute-by-minute level. So they're getting real-time information on their energy usage to a mobile application, so they know exactly how much money they've got in their budget, how much money they've used in energy, and what they can afford to use for the rest of the month. So it's projects like that that have given us, you know, tremendous satisfaction over this sort of growing period, which has been phenomenally difficult but satisfying because of those choices that we've made.
I absolutely love this. I mean, for people watching, as I say, we've talked about how Zaf and I have known each other for a long time. We've not had this discussion. It's relevantly irrelevant. I have an electric car. I have solar panels. We've never thought to have this conversation. So I absolutely could dive in like a geek into this, but we'll save it for another time. Maybe between you and I, or if people would like a follow up, we'd be very happy to do so. And I've just had somebody say, "Great session." So thank you both very much. So we come down to the last 4 minutes, and I want to give us the opportunity to close appropriately. And I guess, If we start to talk about this journey that we've taken together over the last hour, we've talked about the choices that we made that led to us working together, the choices that led to us taking slightly different career paths in the same sector, and the choices that have led us today. But what I'd love to hear, Zaf, is if you could, what advice would you give to the Zaf that was on that floor the day we met? What choices would you maybe say they're good? Maybe avoid those ones. I'm afraid you've only got 3 minutes to cover it off as well.
The first thing that comes to mind is if I tried giving myself any advice, I'd probably ignore it, knowing who I was back then. But with all the pearls of wisdom that I've got now, let me think of three things that I would say. First of all, that my father was right. Compound interest can work harder than you can. Where I believed once upon a time hard work was the solution to everything, now I know that there are capabilities out there that can multiply your efforts. Use the tools, use the people, use those capabilities. You know, it doesn't take anything away from you, it just multiplies your own effort. I suppose another piece of advice that I would give myself is, take care of your personal environment. So as well as enjoying a well-rounded professional career, I would say live near water, live in capital cities, and live in nature if you can. And I would say that's almost as important as all the great input that I've got to my career, is give yourself those personal experiences along the journey that make sure that you can really feed both sides of yourself. Mm-hmm. And as a final nugget, I suppose I would say respect the data. Going back, meeting myself as early Zaf, I would say there's a reason that DAR wants all those metrics. The reason that we're capturing all those KPIs is that you can prove to your upper management that we're either working as hard as we say we are, we need extra staff, or we've got weaknesses in these areas. Just anecdotes won't cut it, but if you can present the data, you can make some really compelling, stories to help your own journey. So absolutely respect the data. It'll take you to places you never dreamt of and introduce you to people you never dreamt of meeting. That's what I would say.
Well, Zaf, I don't think I can say any words that could finish any better than you did then. I just want to thank you so much for agreeing to be my first guest. This has been
my pleasure.
An experience. I've really enjoyed the conversation. If there's an interest, and I believe from the comments that we've had, there should be an interest in following up. I would definitely follow up with Zaf about Apero. I look forward to seeing you and Nazir in Wired magazine at the very least. And we've already had a couple of people express some interest. And all I'd like to say is a big thank you, Zaf, for joining me. A big thank you to those of you that have tuned in and asked questions.
Yes, thank you, everyone.
It's been brilliant for a first episode that people have done that. So thanks very much. And being on a YouTube platform, it would be rude of me not to say, if you've enjoyed it, please like, comment, and subscribe. Thank you all so much, and I hope to be presenting this to you soon with another guest. So take care now.